I would break it up into two parts. Definitely research technical skills. Basically, like knowing how to do research. I know that's very broad, but then the second one is collaboration and communication. I think, honestly, I thought I would be doing a lot, like, I thought I would be doing like 80% research and 20% collaboration and communication in my role, but it turns out to be pretty much 50-50, and sometimes even 40% research, 60% collaboration and communication.
Hello, everyone. In this episode, I'm talking to Monica Chen, who is a UX researcher at Amazon. Monica talks about her career journey in research, starting from academics. We touch on the challenges she faced during remote studies during COVID, which was her first big time experience doing it remote, and what it really takes to be a researcher. She also shares her research methods, her favorite research methods, tips for those new to research, and advice for designers who want to work well with researchers, which I hope everyone is one of those. We also dive into how to convince people that research is crucial for the projects, and talk about whether AI could ever take over a researcher's job. Enjoy. Hello, Monica. Hello. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good to meet you. Yeah,
yeah, it's a real pleasure, and it's a while. I'm glad that you came to the show, and I'm looking forward to asking you a few questions on overall the life of researchers and what challenges you face with, and how designers like myself can be better project partners, and really how to make this relationship and collaboration stronger. So this is kind of the main framing for the conversation.
Yeah.
But let's start with your story. And first of all, like, I'm curious to understand, why did you choose this profession, first of all? And how did you do it? Like, how did you get in? And what do you do today?
Yeah. So yeah, let me start by talking about myself, my background. So I guess I first heard about UX research pretty early on. I was in college, and you know, my degree was in mechanical engineering, and it was tied very closely with like the design school. So I did a lot of projects to do with design thinking, and you know, user research is a big part of like that whole design process, and that was how I was first exposed to it. I didn't really think I would, you know, become a user researcher. Actually, I didn't even know that there was a sort of job called UX researcher back then. I just knew that this kind of exists in the design process. Yeah. But I think later on, and then I went into the field of education technology after college, and I decided to do my doctoral research in education technology because this was an area that I was very passionate about, and I wanted to leverage my technical background in the area of social impact and education. So as I was doing my doctoral program, that took 5 years, by the way, I also at the same time explored more of the field of user research. And, you know, it looks very different in different types of industries just because of the content you're researching, the people that you work with. Like the
technologists too,
right? Yeah, the people that you know use the product are also very different use cases. So yeah, I started exploring industry UX research through doing internships during my doctoral program, internships and contract work. Yeah, so I figured, you know, I was interested in academia, but I also wanted to find out, you know, like what else is there out there in industry, so that I could make an informed decision at the end of the 5 years. Yeah, so that was kind of how I explored it. And yeah, I think networking is really important, getting informational interviews, asking alumni about what they do, and finding out more about like how alumni from my program also went into UX research later on. Yeah, I think that all helped me in terms of like paving my path and just exploring this area. Yeah. So I ended up choosing to do UX research after my doctoral program because I figured that I wanted a job that was, you know, fast-paced, thriving, and this sort of, you know, fast-changing environment. I wanted to be doing something in the area of emerging technologies. And, you know, the tech space is definitely, like, you know, on the top of my list. And I think at the same time, I wanted to grow in different kinds of research methods and skills. In my doctoral program, I leaned qualitative. So a lot of what I did was interviewing and observations. I worked very closely with schools and teachers and kids. I focused on the K-12 space. So yeah, elementary and middle school students. Yeah. But I also wanted to learn more about quant methods, quantitative methods, like data science, data analytics, things like that. And I felt that UX research would expose me to this kind of broader skill set. And I've just basically wanted a job that I felt I would continuously be learning. Yeah. So yeah, I made the decision to go into UX research after academia.
So how does, and now you work at Amazon, right?
Yes.
And I guess your decision to go to the technology, like to the tech world and do research there, trying to get yourself into a position in the place where it's like super fast paced, like lots of things changing. How does really, like, did it really hit the mark of your expectation of the change, of the pace of the changes, especially with the AI developments, right? So like, how do you really... It feels like the pace is just skyrocketing right now. And I wonder if that's really what you were looking for.
Yeah, I think it's definitely lived up to my expectations. And I did sort of expect this going in, just because I have a bunch of friends who work in tech. And, you know, I ask them questions about their jobs and they tell me what's going on. So, yeah, I'm right now at Amazon. I work under the Alexa organization. So Alexa is the voice assistant. Alexa's been around for a few years already, so it's not like a super brand new product. It's more mature. There has been research done in this space. There are also senior and principal researchers in Alexa to learn from and be mentored. But I mean, like, I've only been at Amazon for 10 months, and there have been big changes over the last 10 months also. Definitely, like, I think a lot of people are talking about generative AI right now, and with the kind of, you know, the onset of ChatGPT, and like a lot of tech companies are all looking into this space. For me, though, like when I first entered, I had not done anything in the field of voice before. So that was a huge learning curve for me to start with. So, you know, it was a lot of background reading, just sometimes also watching, like, you know, YouTube videos about what is voice technology, what's out there in this space apart from Alexa. I also went to a conference last year on voice, just to be exposed to more like companies and startups that are doing different things in the whole space of voice. Yeah. That was kind of my own professional development along the way to find out more about the content so that I could, you know, do good research in this area. Yeah.
Speaking of voice, I dabbled with designing for voice assistants, just kind of as my own kind of side, I guess, interest, curiosities, a couple of years ago. But I've never really designed for voice, like, as a part of my job. So I've never, and like to continue this, I've never worked with researchers who would be really trying to, do research for this particular kind of interface. So I wonder what were your learnings, because you kind of, it's almost like to me, like as an outsider, right, to the research profession, it feels like it's a very different environment that you have, like, kind of you do this, but maybe you can share more, like, from the firsthand experience, like, how is it different? Like, how is the researching doing, like, user research for voice interfaces is different from the typical graphic user interfaces?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So in Alexa, I mean, we have many devices. So some of the devices have a voice, like a screen. So like an Amazon Echo Show, it has a screen. So you are doing both voice and sort of that UX screen sort of related to visuals type of research. But then we also have devices that do not have a screen. So like the Echo Dot. And that is entirely sounds, commands, utterances, and interactions through voice. So I do research with both sets of customers who have both devices. So it's been interesting to see, like, you know, sort of sometimes there's a difference, sometimes there's not too much of a difference in terms of interaction in certain use cases. But I think what was really helpful for me at the start, learning about the voice space and also learning more about conversation designers' roles, because I had not worked with a conversation designer before, was that there is something called Alexa Voice Academy, and it's like a professional development series as part under Amazon internally for employees like me to learn more about voice technologies and conversation design. And this is led by a few senior conversation designers in the team in Alexa. So one, we had to do like a sort of like a capstone project, mini, very small project, but we had to kind of like put ourselves in the shoes of a designer, think of like a scenario where a human is interacting with Alexa, and, you know, what would the conversation look like? How would the turns look like? What would you say, what would you expect Alexa to say back to you? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm on a team that is called Alexa Identity and Personality, which is really interesting because we think about, you know, the personality piece, like a voice assistant having a personality. Like how does that spice up the engagement with the customer? And what are they really looking for? And we have so many different kinds of customers. So and different kinds of use cases. So some people live alone, some people live with a family, with kids, some people just live with roommates. Yeah. So my research kind of delves into, like, you know, how all these different types of situations, like, you know, how do they interact with that voice assistant? And also, how do they expect to be identified by Alexa? Like, you know, is that similar to how, you know, humans and humans each other, like, identify themselves, or are they expecting something different? Yeah. So I think these are sort of the foundational questions that I work on. Sometimes it's more evaluative sort of usability type of research, where I work more closely with the designer. There is a prototype or mock-up going on. So both types. Yeah.
What would you say, if at all, there was like maybe a surprising learning from at least voice UI studies? Like, what was really kind of was maybe unexpected?
Something unexpected. So I think there was one customer comment that I came across before a few months ago that kind of questioned, like, do I have to speak in a different tone or a different kind of use different, like a formal kind of language to speak to Alexa? Can I, you know, because maybe at home you speak more colloquially, you'll use some slang, you use some different verbiage. And then to Alexa, you got to speak all formal. Like, yeah. Mm-hmm. So they kind of question, like, I need to change. I need to like code switch to speak to Alexa. And that is like not so natural, but I've gotten used to it, sort of thing. So I thought that was interesting, surprising to me. So for example, for me, I speak to Alexa in my very neutral accent. I realized I didn't even like think about it after, you know, before seeing that comment from the customer. And I'm from Singapore, so we have like our Singlish accent, our slang and everything. I was like, yeah, I don't speak to my Alexa in Singlish. I speak to Alexa in a very neutral tone. So that just got me thinking, like, you know, are we changing our behavior to fit a voice assistant, a robot? or and like AI, or should the AI adapt to us? So I think that's a deeper sort of ethical question also, but it was somewhat surprising to me to learn, and just something I didn't really think about.
That's very interesting. And the reason I asked this is because as a part of my job, like outside of my day jobs, historically I've always enjoyed qualitative research activities. Let's put it this way, by like interviewing, mm-hmm. conversations, like really, because I'm very curious about like human behavior, like really mm-hmm. kind of perception of the world, or like this part of the feature, or like overall this problem space and so on. So I'm really curious about that. And recently I was like trying to analyze what really brings me so much joy, why I'm joining these conversations. It's really all this unexpected, surprising, potentially tiny learnings, but like that kind of really so different from how you look at a problem, or like at this topic or this question. And like, oh, that's actually, I didn't even know that you could even question that, or like ask this question. So, and this is kind of, I was really curious to hear what was your takeaway, surprise. Yeah, it's very interesting. Reminds me of this, I think, older debate of the should Alexa be like is it a female or male, like, and like how, like what all this kind of creates, like this balance of powers, like people commanding to Alexa because she has like a female name. So it's kind of really, kind of opens up a big kind of like potential worms, mm-hmm. because ethics is, I would say, could be a subjective and like a mm-hmm. relative term, right? Mm-hmm. Especially if you start thinking about different regions and different parts of the world. And for you, I think like you probably experienced it yourself, because if you lived in Singapore, like in the Asian part of the world, versus like now in North America in the States, I would suspect that there will be some differences in how even like research or insights could be like what insights that would they reveal about how people perceive this kind of device and this kind of potentially voice Alexa identity, right? Because it's kind of part of your team. So I wonder if there was like any international research that kind of also surprised you, like in how different parts of the world and different types of customers have different expectations potentially. Mm-hmm. And like, I think this is a very interesting gem that you just brought up about like that, like, should I change my tone and voice? Yeah. Like,
I unfortunately have not done any international research. So a lot of my work is just North America region. So I don't know for sure. Like, I'm sure there are like cultural differences, habitual differences also, and perceptions towards AI. But yeah, I haven't done any research in that area. I do want to though, like, so right now, actually, you mentioned about the like male versus female voice. So Alexa can, you can switch Alexa to have a male voice. You can switch Alexa to have other types of accents. It doesn't have to be an American. You can have a British accent now, Australian. And So there are more variations. I think localization is definitely something that is a big priority. So yeah, I'm excited to see where this goes. But yeah, I don't know about the international research as much. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think you also bring a good point about just overall the problem of internationalization, and mm-hmm. the problem not like that because everybody's different, but because of how do you design something, an mm-hmm. experience that works and adjusts to different expectations and needs, like based on culture, I know, any other parameters, right? So it's kind of, it definitely makes it more challenging to design products and experiences, but I think it also adds more work for researchers, right? To really gather diverse inputs and like diverse kind of even like segments from the audience from the base user base to avoid making mistakes that maybe remember this I think it was Mitsubishi company who released like a one of their car models, and this was like the name of the model was I think Pajero like in English. but I think it was like a really bad word, like in Spanish or something, and like they didn't do research.
Oh, okay.
And like it kind of always comes to mind, like about this, the unforeseen potential problems and risks of actually not considering the global audience, right, for products. And with all this digital technology, I mean, the goal is obviously not just kind of stay within America, right? So it's kind of really be global offer of this experience. So it's definitely, yeah, it makes it more interesting, but also more challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Speaking of challenges, maybe because before Amazon, before kind of voice UI, right? So you kind of, you were focusing more on the graphical user interfaces, right? Research and education pieces as well, education parts, industry. What maybe was the most challenging research study that you had to do? And why was it
most challenging? Oh man, this is hard.
Too many.
Do you mean most challenging in terms of like the content or in terms of collaboration or
anything? Yeah. Like really kind of that, but it was really difficult to pull off because it's a really kind of, it's a multifaceted activity, like with many kind of parts that kind of make it challenging. So like overall, like anything that comes to mind.
I see. I could say like I think so. That was one contract position I did. It was a very short contract because it was such a tight timeline. So I guess in that sense, challenging was the timeline already in itself. So it was 1 month, about 4 to 5 weeks, and I was tasked, and this was like right in the at the start of the pandemic. So it was like May, June, 2020. And basically the world was in chaos. Like people didn't know what was going on. And, you know, universities were shutting down. I also found myself in like, just like suddenly remote and didn't know where to go. But, basically the question was, how are professors in computer science, who teach undergrad or graduate, like the most introductory computer science course, how are these professors handling emergency remote teaching in COVID? And also the tool in question was Microsoft Visual Studio Code. So, you know, how are they using tools to do remote teaching, and how might any of these changes in workflows impact how they use these, like, for example, Visual Studio Code. And I think it was challenging because it was such a new situation, for one. Like, no one knew how to do research during a pandemic yet. It was going to be entirely remote research, of course. And I think for recruitment, I was kind of left alone to recruit however I want to recruit. And there wasn't any like external like vendor support. So it was basically me cold emailing, sending cold emails to professors that I found online. So I just, I looked at, you know, many different universities. I was trying to get a wide range of professors in like private universities, large state universities, smaller liberal arts colleges, HBCUs. HBCUs is historically Black colleges and universities in the US. And also my client wanted a little more of like maybe some international, like internationally based professors. So I was just searching online for who teaches the CS 101 course in this university, send them some cold emails like, hey, would you like to participate in this focus group that I'm organizing for this client? And, you know, to talk about like how you've been adjusting to this change and how your students have been adjusting to the change too. And I was, recruitment was difficult in that sense because I had to hunt it down on my own, but I was amazed by the response that I got. Like so many professors replied to me back and they were like, yes, I need to talk about this. Like they were even reaching out I don't know what's up with my mental health, but I think I need even just a community to talk to. And yeah, so I organized these focus groups. So about four or five professors in one group. And then, you know, I had a whole like protocol of getting through like my focus group questions. But it was just them sharing about their perspectives. Like, oh, I'm doing it, running it this way. You know, our budget got cut. So I'm running it completely differently now, adapting to the situation. Yeah. And you could tell the differences really between, you know, what professors at private universities. So universities, usually those universities have larger like funding and versus like smaller colleges or even just state universities, like, yeah, and the resources that they have are different. So for me, I think it was my first time managing focus groups entirely remotely. Had not done that before. So I would say like, that was my own personal challenge. Like, you know, I kind of had to step it up and adapt to the situation. Yeah. But I think like data analysis was very interesting for me because I was piecing together all these different things that they were saying and coming back to my client and the product lead to figure out like, okay, so, you know, what are they talking about? How can we help them firstly, like by improving on the product? Are there any features that are in the roadmap to be built, or should we, you know, kind of redirect or reorient how this product roadmap is going to look like for the next 3 to 6 months? So I think these were like deep questions that really had to think about. And I mean, my client brought it back. Yeah. So brought it back to their team internally. Yeah, so I think I was quite proud of myself for just managing this in 4 to 5 weeks also during a pandemic with these, my focus group participants were also like, you know, they were participative, but, you know, I had to kind of build rapport with them and like know that they're not in the best state of mind also. yeah, so I think just managing all these moving parts. Yeah,
it's a very interesting example. I like it. And it almost makes me feel that researcher's job is kind of part like therapist job, so to say, because humans are humans, right? So, and you kind of, you have to interact with humans and you have to ask questions and observe. But besides the main focus of your study, there are so many influences, like in this example, right? Like all this stress and like uncertainty mm-hmm. that really impacts how they think and how they would potentially respond, right? So I think that you have to be a really good professional researcher to be able to almost like not shepherd, but kind of help the user to forget those things for a moment. So kind of you can focus on the study, or at least somehow be more clear what's influencing them, right? So because it's almost like, yeah, like a therapy, it feels like it. How do you really, yeah, manage humans? it's definitely a difficult job.
Yeah. But it was a very interesting experience for me. And and then after that, I was like, okay, I can do remote research. Yes. It was like confidence boost for myself too.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Every time you kind of you push yourself out of the comfort zone, right? And you kind of you come out as a better professional, as a better expert, as a better human, hopefully. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you a couple more questions about you as a researcher as a profession.
Okay.
And part of this question is almost like my just personal curiosity that I have been, I would say, at least pondering a bit. So I'll touch on this a bit later. But first question, what would you say like a must-have skills for a person to become a user researcher?
Yeah, must-have skills. I think I would break it up into two parts. Definitely research technical skills. Basically like knowing how to do research. I know that's very broad, but then the second one is collaboration and communication. I think, honestly, I thought I would be doing a lot, like I thought I would be doing like 80% research and 20% collaboration and communication in my role, but it turns out to be pretty much 50-50 and sometimes even 40% research, 60% collaboration and communication. Because at the end of the day, you can do all the research that you want, but if it is not shared out, if it's not socialized properly, or if your stakeholders don't fully understand what the action items are from the research, then nothing's going to be done with it. Nothing's going to be implemented. Yeah. So I think these two areas are super important.
Very interesting. Maybe you could elaborate a bit more on, I guess, convincing stakeholders and making sure that they understand the insights. And maybe you can share some pro tips of how can you increase the adoption of the results of your work.
Yeah, I think it's a work in progress. Honestly, I'm still trying to improve my communication and collaboration with my stakeholders. But I think say in a research report that I write or a slide deck that I present, I always have a slide or kind of a paragraph at the end to talk about my recommendations and what should the next steps be. And I also have time during the presentation. I save about like 20 to 30 minutes for discussion for my stakeholders. And I ask them back questions like, what do you think of my recommendations? Does this make sense? Is it feasible? Is this something being worked on already in like the product roadmap? Or is it something brand new that we haven't even really thought about? Yeah. So I always prepare questions for myself also to ask them back about these insights and recommendations so that we can get into sort of like a discussion mode about what are we going to do and how do we take this away? Yeah. There's usually some follow-up to do after a research share out or presentation. So sometimes, say one of my stakeholders might ask for like, oh, can I have a little more data on this sub question that maybe wasn't answered fully in that research presentation, then maybe I have to kind of dig deeper into the data, get back to them about that part of it. But sometimes it snowballs into a new research study. So, and then that would be added to my research roadmap. Yeah, so there's a lot of back and forth. There's also like, you know, check-ins, like sometimes things can't be done in the next month or two. Sometimes it needs to be, you know, like tabled to the next quarter or even next half of a year. And it's all about going back and like doing another sync or check-in. Staying in touch, like whenever my designer has a design review, sometimes with the director, I just sit in and observe the session and also listen to the director's feedback because that gives me sort of like clues to think ahead about, how can I help my designer get to the next stage and also, you know, help the whole team to think ahead a little. Yeah. So... yeah,
that's a very good point because I think especially because when you as a researcher observe those design presentations to leadership team, right? I like how you phrase it, like it gives you clues because actually it you can get ideas on what maybe additional data points you can gather to help designer communicate the rationale or the decisions behind this the rationale behind the decisions better, so the director or whoever the leadership team person is can I guess go along the way and accept that rationale. That's a really good point. talking about the hard skills, what you, so you initially said like the two groups of skills, right? Like hard skills and soft skills.
Yes.
Hard skills is basically all the research methods, right? And the like qualitative and quantitative. Mm-hmm. Is it right?
Yes.
What would you say your favorite research method and the least favorite and why?
This is really difficult. Like, I don't think I have a least favorite one. Yeah, because honestly, there are so many research methods, and I feel, I mean, I don't think I have tried every single one of them. So yeah, I don't think I have a least favorite one. My favorite one to date is observations. I like to be immersed in the participants' setting, environment, when they're telling me, kind of like in a think out loud sort of mode, like what they're doing, how they're interacting with sometimes the tool or the product in question in their context. And I think it's really interesting because, you know, sometimes I have assumptions and biases as a human, and I come in and I think they're going to do something, but they do something different. And that is kind of what I'm looking for. I'm like, oh, you know, it's something that I didn't expect, or I didn't even see it this way when they were in this context. Yeah. So I think observations has to be my favorite method. Yeah.
Personally, observations is also my favorite method because it's, I don't know why, like, but it's probably packed with surprises. And especially if you have a chance to follow up and like kind of really dig deeper into what you just observed, I think this is what kind of my favorite part. Mm-hmm. The most challenging though, like at least what I've heard and kind of makes sense to me, again, as a non-researcher, but like I've done a lot of research activities, let's put it this way, is surveys. Mm, I've heard that surveys are probably require the most expertise from the researcher to create the right survey. So the questions are not leading like all this kind of the quote to the questions, because it can like the impact can be actually worse. Like the learnings can be so incorrect that it actually can lead the team down their own path, right? Mm-hmm. So, and talking about like really when non-researchers, when non-qualified researchers have to do research, right? Either designers or sometimes product managers or who else? Maybe these are the two main folks who would be doing this.
Marketing also, I think, maybe.
Marketing? Maybe. Yeah, could be marketing, yeah. What would you say, really kind of the top three things to keep in mind for a person who doesn't know like as well, like, and how to avoid potentially the biggest risks of doing this research themselves, so they don't come back with incorrect learnings and create more damage through this.
Yeah, I think I think sometimes if you're working on a product for so long, you use the technical terms that are kind of internal, like in the company. And then you say, and maybe say you're interviewing, maybe you're doing a quick usability test and you have to ask some questions to the participant, or you need to send out like a very quick 5-question sort of small survey. And then you use all those technical jargon in it. And then sometimes that confuses the participant, or sometimes they're not sure what they should really answer. So yeah, I think that is one area, like, you know, just think about it from like a non-technical perspective. Like, what would you say to a customer in layman's terms about like a certain feature that you want to test? Yeah. So I think that's one. I mean, another one, I think you mentioned like on asking like leading questions, if you want to kind of dig into their opinions broadly, you can always start with broader questions rather than ask like, in this situation, like, would you do this or that? And there are only two choices, this or that. it's like, you know, broaden it up, because they might tell you things that you also might not have expected. So I think those are two that I can think of at the top of my mind. But in my team, when there is more like designer-led or PM-led research or experiments, they do still consult with the research team. So they're not like completely on their own. They might run a study draft with us and we kind of look through it and say like, okay, yeah, I think that looks good. Or we give them some pointers on like things to tweak. Yeah. So yeah, I think that's how we've been doing it so far for non-researcher led research.
Yeah, I think it's a smart way to at least try to scale the research efforts and the value from research is by almost like working as a centralized consultancy, right? So like other people can do that, but like with your guidance and your maybe like self-help resources, maybe you just kind of have like this office hours when you kind of review and provide recommendations. I think that's actually a really good way, yes. And I've actually done this quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But when we did have like a dedicated research on the team.
Yeah. And I think it's good to have designers or PM lead some smaller research projects sometimes, because that also kind of immerses them into the research role a bit. And I feel then they understand the researcher's job better overall. And, you know, when they're getting all these insights and like discussing as a whole team, like what to do with those insights. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm a proponent for that.
Yeah, it's the same here. Okay, now the second, I guess, we already had five other questions in addition to the first main one. But the second question is more personal and like coming from my own thinking, my own thoughts. So imagine that there is a designer somewhere, hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
And what would you say, what would you think could be the signals in this designer's thoughts that they may be better off being a researcher instead of designer? And maybe it's a time for them to kind of consider a different career track. And I'm not saying it's me, but frankly, I'm just kind of, I was analyzing all the, I guess, recent and like historical projects that I worked on. And the research phase and like those interviews and conversations and observation has been probably at the top of the list, top three activities that I really, really enjoy, like really kind of brings me joy, right? And I'm looking forward to. So I want, like, a certain question, like, does it mean that I maybe should be more doing like research than design, than like moving boxes on the screen? So yeah, curious to hear, like, as an expert in this field, like, what kind of signals you think could a person be looking for?
Yeah. That's a really interesting question, because I've answered this question more to like students who are thinking, should I do UX design or UX research? I'm not sure. Rather than, I'm a UX design professional for many years already, but considering a switch to UX research. So that's interesting. I think, like, honestly, yes, it does depend on interest. Like, I think the main thing is, if you are drawn to the research portion of the whole sort of design process, then sure, you know, you could go into sort of that space to do a bit more research. I think at Amazon, there's this role called design strategist, where I think there is one person on my team who is a principal design strategist. So he has a lot of design, ton of design experience, I think like decades of design experience. But he's not doing the day-to-day sort of like, you know, moving things on Figma around kind of design. He doesn't do the mock-ups or wireframes things as much. He's very much forward-looking and thinking of design concepts, like sort of the bigger picture sort of thing, which I feel sort of goes into the research part a little. Yeah, very foundational work. I'm always very inspired by his presentations because, number one, they look so good aesthetically because he is a designer. But then he focuses on like the strategy, like thinking ahead, even like 2-3 years down the road kind of thing. So so that's, I think that's a role that kind of touches into research, but it's I guess it's not, he isn't called a researcher. Yeah. But he's called a design strategist. Yeah. I'm not sure if like a lot of companies have this role, maybe at larger tech firms like Amazon, there is, but maybe in other companies it's called different roles. Maybe it is called like principal researcher, for example. Yeah. So yeah, I think that's what comes to mind. I think there's no harm trying research projects a little more if you're interested in, you know, doing more research rather than design. I think it is a fairly easy switch if you do want to kind of go down the research route, having been a UX designer already. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. The only, I guess, the biggest concern I have like exploring these ideas is that from all the activities and things that a researcher does and has to do as a part mm-hmm. of the job, I kind of I'm drawn towards only one particular method and kind of basically only a subset of all the possible things that the researcher mm-hmm. will have to do, right? So because I'm not really looking forward to writing reports and all that stuff, which takes way more time, as I understand, and all recruiting yes. of participants. This is super frustrating, frankly, mm-hmm. and feels very tedious very often. Like how you described, like when you were doing this guerrilla style sourcing yeah. of participants, I would not really enjoy that if it was my job. So I'm kind of, that's kind of, it stops me on the kind of going forward with this kind of the whole job switch, so to say, idea. So it's more like just kind of exploration, just or interesting observations.
You could, or you could try like sort of like the 80-20. So you're still 80% a designer and then 20% working on another project that is more foundational, maybe needs to do a little bit more research. I know some teams have a research operations partner who takes care of like the budgeting, licenses, yeah, like sometimes recruitment management also, or you could source it out to vendors so you don't have to do the recruitment on your own if there is the yeah. budget on your team. So yeah, I think there are strategies around that to do things that you like more rather than, you know, to kind of do all the logistics on your own. Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's actually an interesting idea about the 80-20 mm-hmm. split. Yeah, I'll explore this.
Yeah.
Okay, so then... let's go to one more question on being a researcher, user researcher, I guess, in a work setting, so to say. Mm-hmm. So thinking about the collaboration between designers and researchers, right? Like mm-hmm. as a, like myself as a designer, I truly want to become better in working with researchers when mm-hmm. I have a chance, when I have an opportunity, right? Because not every project has a researcher. So what, like from your point of view, from your side of this relationship, what maybe advice can you give to designers, how they can be better partners?
Yeah. So I would say researchers like to plan things in advance, knowing that our research studies can't just fly in the next 2 weeks and suddenly work out. So I think a major one is, you know, like when we plan roadmaps at the start of the year or say like Q4 into the next year and we share out these roadmaps, try to align it with product and design. I think it's great to have the designers' feedback about where they think they're going with their roadmaps also, and let us know in advance, like, maybe potentially like a research project for this area needs to happen like say at the end of Q1 or start of Q2. So giving us sort of like a signal on so that we know maybe to block off some time or buffer it, you know, give plus minus 1 week to have just some space to do that research. So I think that's always good. Like, you know, if a designer comes to me and be like, I need this, like, you know, in 2 weeks for some design review. Like, I need results in like the next 2 weeks. I'm like, I don't think that's gonna work out. But yeah,
go away.
yeah, and like sometimes, you know, our research roadmap is quite packed. We already have 3 or 4 projects like ongoing. It's like, I don't even know whether we have the budget to fit a sudden, like, you know, thing that came up. Yeah. And I feel bad saying no, but sometimes I really have to say no to, like, things that are very last minute in that sense. Yeah. So definitely, like, the timing of it is important. I think being a good partner, so I know sometimes there are multiple design reviews or, like, you know, updates to be made to a mock-up or a concept. I personally like to be kept in the loop for these design reviews, even though, like, I may not be directly participating in it at the moment. Yeah, so to just kind of know where the whole project is going, what kind of feedback stakeholders are giving to my designer, I think that just gives me a much better context. So if, you know, my designer includes me in those, I would happily participate and observe. Yeah. I know this might not be the case for all designers. Like, they might not have, like, this sort of timeline, but to just keep me updated as they go along in the project would be amazing. Yeah. So I think it's a lot about communication, honestly. Yeah.
So what you mentioned at the beginning about coming to you a bit in advance, so you have more time notice, right? Longer notice. How would you help designer? Mm-hmm. Like, what advice would you give designer who also needs to convince their stakeholders that actual research is needed, so it's already included in the plan and not mm-hmm. kind of only one design gets to their yeah. part? Because obviously kind of constraints are always there, mm-hmm. Prioritization, everything, and different opinions as well with different stakeholders, right? So do you have, like, any quick tips, pro tips on how to really, yeah, convince stakeholders that research is needed?
Yeah. So stakeholders other than design, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think it goes both ways. So, you know, the designer letting me know in advance, like, hey, we might need some research help in, like, 3 months. But for me to also tell my designers and stakeholders, like, I think you're going to need some research for this area if you go down this path. And I think that also takes time to really, you know, it takes time to understand where your team is going. Like, when I was newer at Amazon, like, in my first 4 to 4 months or so, I still didn't really have a good sense of, like, where my team is headed to, what had been done in the past. And I think with some time, you get to know, like, the context a lot better to be able to suggest to the team, like, okay, I'm going to block out this part for research because I think that's going to happen. You need research for the next step to happen. Yeah. So I think just communicating with my non-UX partners about that also, especially for, like, product, if they are leading up to, like, a PR, FAQ, product review, something like that, then to let them know, like, hey, maybe you know, to bolster your idea or your hypothesis, then we need to do some research before you get to that. And, like, since you have that deadline, then we need to kind of work backwards a bit from there so that we have enough time for research. Yeah. So yeah, I think that would be my strategy. Yeah.
Sounds good. Okay. And one of the, I guess, recently interesting developments with AI, right? And all this headlines and everything that, like, AI can replace everyone and so on. Yeah. So one of the use cases, one of the scenarios that people shared online is that AI, like, talking about ChatGPT and, like, this kind of text generative systems, can generate research, user mm-hmm. research, which yeah. obviously from our industry, like, from our side of design, design researcher, like, first of all, looking at this, it sounds like ridiculous. But I wonder what you can say about really the idea that AI, like, tools like we have today, can generate personas and really mm-hmm. do research for you.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I don't think we should shy away from ChatGPT or generative AI tools that can help us do work more efficiently, honestly. So yeah, I made a joke that's going to take my job, maybe. But like, you know, I think there are things that I can focus on more, like, you know, if like, say I have a Gen AI tool that is helping me develop some personas. The thing is, like, maybe it helps me develop like three really key personas, but maybe I still have to do it just a bit more searching around to make sure that I'm not leaving out, say, any marginalized group or any like sort of edge cases that could potentially be a very key persona to my question also. So I think, you know, it's great that, oh, you know, it pops up three personas, and then I can spend more time working on that fourth one that I feel like, you know, is also relevant for my work. And I think, like, in terms of like ChatGPT or Gen AI being able to summarize articles really quickly, like they give you, you know, you type in like, what is the summary of this paper? They spit out sort of like a one paragraph summary. I think that's great. For me, I'm still figuring out how my workflow would look like. Like, you know, sure, reading the summary is good. For me, I still kind of read through like the abstract. So like either the intro paragraph or the executive summary and then the conclusion area to make sure that, okay, I kind of have the same sense as to what ChatGPT is telling me. Yeah. But then actually at the moment in Amazon, I don't think ChatGPT is allowed on our work laptops. So yeah, have not been using ChatGPT in that sense. But I know for like, say, conversation designers, I think probably we are exploring like, how can content creation be more efficient with Gen AI? Yeah. And I think that's still very much in a work in progress. We're still, you know, tinkering around with different things and seeing how things work in our workflow. Yeah. So yeah, I'm excited though for to explore more about Gen AI and how to integrate that into my work. Yeah. Like maybe in terms of data collection, data analysis also down the road. I haven't really explored that now, but yeah, I think it's not too far in the future.
So what do you think about the startups who claim mm-hmm. that they can generate research insights without the users? Yeah,
so it depends on who their users are. Like if it's a users that are like the mass population, maybe what they get from Gen AI is actually pretty accurate, and you know, they don't have to test and keep testing with like so many of the real users, because there is a lot of data out there and Gen AI is kind of just summarizing it for them. I think it really depends. So yeah, if you have a more targeted niche audience, then maybe, you know, it would warrant more like kind of rigorous research with that particular audience. I'm thinking of like minors also. I'm not sure how much information there is on kids or like, say, groups yeah. that may be marginalized. They like people who might be disabled or have like a certain condition, then maybe you still have to do like more specific research with those like real people. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, last question. If money wasn't a question, what would you do?
Oh man. I would, if money wasn't an issue, like how would that change my research, right?
No, just your life. It's not like work related. It's like open.
My yeah. life.
Imagine you won a lottery and you don't have to worry about money ever.
I would travel a lot more for one. I think I mentioned observation was my favorite method. So I like to be immersed in new places, in new
cultures.
Where
would you go?
I would go around the world. I don't know, everywhere around the world to places that I have not yet explored. I guess I haven't explored Africa and Latin America as much yet. So definitely visit a lot of countries over there. Yeah. And I think I had this like, you know, when I was younger, sort of like a longer term dream of going into philanthropy. Because I I used to work with some nonprofits. I volunteered a lot, but they always, like, always funding is always an issue. And I took a philanthropy class, like, back in college, and tried to understand how philanthropists also, like, donate their money, how they put funding, how do they even prioritize that climate should be above health or something like that? It kind of
That's a
is based
tricky
on, like,
question.
it's based on their personal values, it's based on interest. But if I had a lot of money, I would donate definitely to, like, schools, universities.
Education, yeah.
I wanna like see how philanthropy would work out in the nonprofit space.
Very
So
interesting.
yeah.
Okay, awesome. So, and to wrap up, where can folks find you if they want to follow up and ask more questions?
Yeah. Definitely on LinkedIn. Connect with me on LinkedIn. I am also mentoring on ADP List, so feel free to also connect with me there. And
Sounds
ADP
good.
List is a it's a platform for, like, free, like, sort of one-on-one mentorship. There's some master courses also, so check it out. I'm a new mentor there, but it's been really interesting meeting people around the world and, who either want to go into technology or find out more about UX research.
Excellent. I'll include the links in the notes. Well, that was a really pleasant and very insightful conversation. I learned quite a few new things about your world as a researcher.
Thank
And
you.
really appreciate your time and coming here and sharing your learnings with the audience.
Yeah, and thanks so much for having me also. I think it was really, you asked me some really deep questions, so that was always interesting.
Sounds good.